what has ever graduated at Monterey King University. By training, as you might expect, an economist. In addition to his private sector business responsibilities, Fernando, who is often confused with David Somerville, the poster boys of the freedom movement in the Americas, also remains affiliated with Monterey King University. He is the treasurer of the university. He is on the economics faculty, teaches principles of economics at the university, and directs its center on society and economics. So, ladies and gentlemen, Fernando Monteros.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you can hear me, because I know most of you won't see me. but the important thing is that you can listen to me. I have been asked to speak to you today on the state of freedom in my country of Guatemala. Thank you. Obviously, the builder had in mind a Texan when he built it. But he made provisions for Latin Americans, too. In Guatemala, we represent 8.5 million of the approximately 18 million people living in Central America. We are located just south of Mexico, and we could say that we sit in your backyard or on your front porch, whichever way you wish to see us. We are middlemen sandwiched between the Marxist dictatorship in neighboring Nicaragua and the land of liberty, as you traditionally exemplify yourselves. And finally, our social significance to you Americans is that in ever greater numbers, our young people are choosing to vote with their feet and heading for your borders because they see an uncertain future and few possibilities for themselves in our countries. This is a problem for you, and it is a problem for us. In 1986, Guatemala joined the mainstream of Latin American countries. After 12 years under military governments, we finally inaugurated a civilian and popular elected president. Since then, freedom has been advanced in a few areas and lost in most. I think it is worthwhile underlining from the start a basic difference between democracy as you know it and practice it here in the United States and democracy as we know it and live it in Central America. In your version of democratic government, checks and balances are built into the government, not just on paper, but in fact. Under your system of checks and balances, even a president can be brought legally down from the presidential seat. This is not the case in our system, although we have the same banners as you do. We wave the banner of democracy, of a written constitution, a civilian president, and a popular elected Congress, and so on. Since 1986, under our new so-called democratic government, progress in individual freedom has marginally increased in the areas of speech and press, but not much elsewhere. The military governments of yesteryear imposed on us their personalized brand of freedom of speech. It consisted of being able to say whatever you wished as long as you didn't say something you shouldn't. Under our present pseudo-democratic government, you are free to say whatever you want. We admit to that. However, the administration has complete control, not only of the executive, but also of the legislative and judicial branches of government. So, in the end, it doesn't matter what you say. The roots of this problem of freedom, this problem of looking like a democracy without being able to exercise the freedoms a democracy implies, began with an all-encompassing, casuistic-type constitution drawn up in 1984 and in 1985, just prior to this present government. In this constitution, our current one, every aspect of social life was given a paragraph. The Constitution guarantees contractual liberties just like in yours. Property rights are taken care of and we have freedom to sell, but as long as the government does not decide to the contrary somewhere along the way. If it's declared of a national emergency, those contractual liberties are stepped on. In short, the founding fathers of our new democracy saw it fit to rule every aspect of life which occurred to them at the time, and they fashioned a tailor-made suit of set of rules to suit their particular style of governing. And while our Constitution establishes an executive, a legislative, and a judicial branch, there is in fact no real balance of power as you know it here in the United States of America. Yes, we have the legal framework to guarantee our constitutional rights, but what we have not found is the means to enforce the executive branch to abide by adverse decisions of the legislative and judicial entities, if this be so. With regards to human rights, we all want to know how has that improved or whether it has not improved. In this area, some will claim that progress has been made, but if we consider our property rights to be a fundamental part of our human rights, then little has been changed, or little has been gained. Our new administration began its rule by creating and widely advertising the concept of a social debt. In this concept of a social debt, they claim that those who have wealth owe it to those that do not have wealth. The president himself comes out on television and has done much to polarize our society, exhorting the have-nots to demand their due from those that have. The social debt concept broke the ground and provided the administration with an excuse for an increase in the government's role in the economy. Government deficit spending is the rule and not the exception. Economic crimes are a new legislative creation, a new legislative atrocity, I might add, and are imposed for selling goods above the government-controlled prices or simply for speculating. The new economic laws even prohibit the storage of goods in expectation of a future profit. Speculators face stiff fines for what our president publicly denounces as speculating with the hunger of the people. That's the way our president, when he comes out on TV, he talks about that these rich merchants are speculating with the hunger of the people. The victims of this economic and legal atrocity are the less influential rural merchants who have less influence and thereby cannot defend themselves as some other could do. The logical outcome of this fiscal persecution has been already mentioned by Mr. Chafuen and will be extensively discussed by Mr. Hernando de Soto, is the flourishing of the informal or underground economy in our country. Common sites in the capital city are come-and-go businesses in panel vans or station wagons, and I imagine that the picture is repeated throughout Latin America. The owner of the station wagon or van simply parks, opens the trunk, and business activity begins. There are so many of these businesses around that authorities are unable to chase vans all around all day. Foreign exchange transactions, but these are not the only type of examples of an informal economy. Other examples are foreign exchange transactions, and which between the 1982 and 1985 actually gave the transfusion to the economy which the government was earnestly trying to suffocate during those dark days of between 1982 and 85. the government imposed a very strict foreign exchange controls, and it was this type of informal economy which actually made us all of our businesses survive. Housing and commodity trading are common examples of this informal or underground economy. As you might know, rents have price controls, and therefore, if you want to rent a house, you have to make a special transaction with the owner. It is estimated that around 40% of our GNP is dealt in this manner, and unfortunately, this percentage is growing. The rejection of market solutions in favor of government intervention is rationalized by the government at all levels of our society. Our socialist and communist neighbors like Cuba, Nicaragua, and Mexico have made it respectable to join the bandwagon of third world mentality. Our governments think it is fit and fashionable to criticize Uncle Sam and side with the so-called non-aligned world. This third world mentality has kept us precisely there, in a third world of poverty. If this wasn't, as if this wasn't enough of a problem, the US presence in the Central American region and your foreign policy is also making it easier for interventionists to discredit the United States version of a democracy with its emphasis on market solutions. Recent events have seriously eroded the United States image in the region, and I'm going to quote some examples. The recent landing of US troops in Honduras in a military show of force was, I think, an unfortunate move. The military display with orders not to engage in combat was meaningless. It eroded the image of the United States unnecessarily. Also, the outcome of the recent congressional election in El Salvador, in which the State Department sponsored Christian Democratic government of Napoleon Duarte was so soundly beaten, was a clear signal that massive United States Department aid to El Salvador has not only undermined the country's comparative advantage, but has also fueled widespread corruption, and that the electorate knows it. Even ignorant and people that don't know how to read or write have now realized that that the United States Department sponsored government is not working, and the elections proved it, and they made some tricks in the thing, and they managed to realign the results. But the initial results were very clear that the Salvadorians are now they understand that this is not the solution. The United States intervention in Panama, trying to oust the corrupt regime of General Noriega, is another unfortunate incident in which the United States image in our territories has suffered. We applaud your efforts in fighting drug trafficking, but General Noriega's doings have certainly been known to you for a long time, and it was only recently that you found it convenient to get rid of him. The above incidents have eroded unnecessarily the image of the United States, and they have had the unfortunate byproduct of making our governments side with the third world. In the final analysis, I believe that the dominant reason why our governments have not had to resort to market forces to solve the problems of creating wealth is that our interventionist governments carry the blessing of the United States State Department's socialist inclined bureaucracy and of the international socialist community nesting in so-called international forums such as the United Nations. Because of international financial assistance, our governments have managed to sustain their deficit spending without having to worry about creating wealth. If it had not been for this continuous bailout, our governments would have run out of resources a long time ago. Instead, the United States State Department's bureaucracy sees to it that our governments are bailed out time and time again, and that our governments, military and civilian, are left free to manage public funds at will without ever having to account to us, their citizens. We feel that this practice serves the international socialist movement just fine, since it leaves our countries ripening at no cost to them until we are ready to be harvested into the international socialist movement. To end, I quote Lord P.T. Bauer's message, which appeared in Forbes magazine of February the 22nd, 1988, regarding development theory. In his message, Lord Bauer recommends that less developed economies be left alone to work out their own problems. He adds that most problems besetting the poorer countries are of our own making and that we should be allowed to fend for ourselves. I think that this is true. Socialists will be discredited only when they run out of economic means to make good their offers. I, therefore, leave you with a parting thought. Let us all see to it, in whichever way we can, that interventionist governments disguised under so-called growing democracies are not bailed out economically. Let us make them accountable to their own people and to their creditors for their use of public funds. Only then can we hope for the implementation of market theory in our growing economies and thus solve the many problems besetting our nations. The result will be a greater freedom for us and peace of mind for you and for us. Thank you very much.